Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing sex advice blogger Professor Foxy. Also, it appears we have a new Supreme Court nominee, so that's probably going to be important. And to counterbalance some of that heavy drama, I've got a segment on Mary Roach and the 10 things you probably didn't know about orgasms. Big and hopeful news coming from the Obama administration.
On last Friday, President Obama sat down with Congress and discussed the proposed budget. And in that budget, President Obama, now prepare yourselves. If you're not sitting down, please go sit down. If you're driving and you're watching this on your cell phone or something, you know, put your seatbelt on, because this is like big news right here. I mean, this is big, big news. He wants to zero out abstinence-only funding.
Of course, congressional Democrats might still be afraid of doing this, so it may not work out. But when a popular president gets behind such a plan, it makes it much easier for Congress to get in line. So I'm optimistic. President Obama has a new nomination for the Supreme Court.
This morning I nominated Judge Sonia Sotomayor of the U.S. Court of Appeals to replace Justice David Souter, who, as you've heard, is retiring after nearly two decades on the Supreme Court.
He has his reasons.
First is mastery of the law, an ability to hone in on the key issues and provide clear answers to difficult legal questions. Second is a recognition that a judge's job is to interpret, not make law, to approach decisions without any particular ideology or agenda, but rather a fidelity to the Constitution. Third is a common touch and a sense of compassion, an understanding of how the world works and how ordinary people live.
And with that, the Supreme Court craziness begins. The talking point of conservatives fighting against an appointee who will be, amongst other things, the first woman of color on the Supreme Court is this: empathy is a horrible, horrible thing to have. Go, Michael Steele.
And a whole lot of saving America's judicial system and saving our rights as citizens and not having empathetic judges decide cases, but rather judges who are actually understanding the rule of law and what the Constitution and those laws are all about and how to apply the facts to the law and the law to the facts and adjudicate my case. I don't need some judge sitting up there feeling bad for my opponent because of their life circumstances or their condition and shortchanging me and my opportunity to get fair treatment under the law. It's crazy nonsense, empathetic. I'll give you empathy. Empathize right on your behind. It's crazy.
Yep, that's the talking point. The idea is that having empathy means that you can't understand the law or how to apply it. In terms of logic, it's what we call a false dilemma. In the real world, good judges understand both the letter of the law and that the people they're trying to serve are human beings. Yes, even the women. And that's the other thing with this empathy crap. It's what you'd call a sexist dog whistle. Empathy is considered a feminine trait, and so bringing this up is a way to get the conservative base to hit the fainting couch should any female nominee come up, which of course is what happened. And that's because gender is absolutely central to the upcoming battle over the Supreme Court seat being left open by Justice Souter. So is race. Conservatives are pinning their last hopes in killing affirmative action, making it legal to discriminate against women and minorities, and paying women less money for equal work on a conservative court. But the real fear is that if someone has empathy, they're going to believe that women have a basic right to control our fertility. And that is what's really at stake every time you hear a right-winger use empathy like it's a dirty word. Take Orrin Hatch, laying more bait.
If you start talking about empathy, do you allow your empathy to change the law so that it meets with your empathetic feelings? Or does that mean that you at least have some sort of a feeling about what really moves the world and makes the world go within the rule of law, the framework of the rule of law? If it's that, fine. But the president also has said that he's going to pick somebody who might use their own political preferences, feelings, or other approaches. And, you know, these are kind of words that bother those of us who think that the judiciary should be limited to what it should do.
I have no idea why it's considered only right and proper to use nothing but code words when talking about Supreme Court nominees, but that's where we are. Hatch almost gives away the innuendo, which is the fear that a female judge will, like Sandra Day O'Connor did, empathize with how much it sucks to be on the receiving end of sexism like discrimination or abortion bans. Since O'Connor was nominated by Reagan, I suspect a number of anti-choicers specifically feel betrayed by her pro-choice views, and it's become traditional to link being pro-choice to all sorts of negative stereotypes about women. The two big ones that are going to be trotted out about Sotomayor is the belief that women are stupid and the belief that women are too emotional to make proper decisions. With this empathy thing, you're seeing the latter. Don't just take my word for it. Paul Gorel at Religion Dispatch is also called the slander of the concept of empathy as misogynist, because it both assumes that things associated with women, like feelings, are wrong, and it also mocks the idea of treating women like people who deserve such a thing as empathy. The other thing to look out for is attacks on Sotomayor's intelligence. Jeffrey Rosen of The New Republic started off by implying that Sotomayor is a lightweight, and Mark Hemingway of the National Review called her dumb and obnoxious. The reality is that Sotomayor has more than 10 years on the Federal Appeals Court, whereas our Chief Justice only had 2. Something to keep in mind during the upcoming battles. I'd like to welcome Professor Foxy to the program. Professor Foxy's real name is Rebecca Fox, and she's the new sex advice columnist for Feministing.com. She's a longtime activist and sex educator, and she's here today on RealityCast to talk about her new stint as a sex advisor. Welcome to RealityCast, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
Is this your first gig as a sex advice columnist, especially one with a focus on a feminist audience?
It is my first time doing it online, but I've been teaching human sexuality for a long time now, which means a lot of that is giving sex advice to mostly undergrads and sometimes teenagers and youth.
I guess a lot of people kind of think of that kind of sex advisor role as being just about like safe sex and contraception and health related issues, though. And you talk on the blog about like relationships and actual sexual practices and pleasure. Was that part of your job before?
It always has been. I think it's more than just about what kind of job it is. It's how you picture sex and sexuality, that sex isn't just what happens between people's legs, but it impacts what happens every day in our lives, how we see ourselves, how we see our partners, how we see strangers on the street, and how we interact in all of those different situations, and really gets to the level of happiness, level of well-being, and how we take care of ourselves.
So what attracted you about being a sex advice columnist, especially one with a focus on a feminist audience?
Well, Miriam Perez, who is a regular writer at Feministing, asked me to do it. Her and I have been friends for a long time. And it seemed like a next natural outgrowth of the kind of work that I was doing around human sexuality already, and just a really good space on Feministing to have these conversations. And frankly, the response has been overwhelmingly positive in a ton of comments and a ton of feedback and so many questions coming in that I can't actually keep up with them at this point.
It seems to me that most of Feministing's commenters are young women. They're usually college-aged. Does this present any interesting challenges for you?
I am 30, so I'm a little bit older than that. But what I actually find interesting is the questions I get are anywhere from teenagers to women. I believe the oldest one I've heard from is in her 60s. And what it makes me realize is that sexuality issues and the things that we think about are pretty consistent over our lifespan. And we're constantly evolving as people, getting more comfortable with our bodies, thinking about trying new things, scared about what our bodies look like and what our bodies can do, or excited about finding out new possibilities. And it's interesting because the woman in her 60s who wrote in talked about discovering her sexuality at that age and how hormone changes are impacting the way that she feels sexually and her sex drive and who her partner choices. And I hear the same thing from women who are 15 and 16 and going through the exact same issue in just a different age group.
What kind of questions do you find the most difficult to answer then?
I find the most difficult ones to be with people who are clearly in pain. So people who are in an abusive relationship or have been sexually assaulted and are trying to deal with that. And it's difficult because in a column, it's not like I'm sitting face-to-face with this person and can help them go through the experience by, you know, hooking them up with a counselor or getting them to a local rape crisis center. Instead, it's this one-time chance to try and help them. And I think it's really important in those scenarios to say this is just a beginning step, and there's no way that a column on any website can I don't want to say solve the problem, but can work them the entire way through the problem and help them get to a really good resolution. If anything, it just has to be a first step. And I also think the situations are difficult because of the anonymous nature of the site, that a lot of people will write in and say things, and at times can be really hurtful. And it isn't talking about an abstract story, it's talking about an actual woman's life and what that looks like, and she's in actual pain. So I think sometimes that needs to be remembered.
From your writing, I get the sense that you lean towards the more open, less rigid views on sexual expression, which is definitely the philosophy of this podcast. I realize, though, that's not necessarily where everybody is kind of coming from, even if they consider themselves feminist or politically progressive. So do you come across a lot of conflict when you would push put forward this kind of philosophy on feministing?
I was actually really worried about that more than anything else. I've always had a really open view around sex and sexuality. I think that's why I teach sex education today. And I was really worried that a lot of the pushback was going to be, that's not okay, or judgmental. And there was one column I wrote about a woman who wrote in saying that she is a really strong feminist, finds herself to be a very assertive woman, but when she has sex with her boyfriend, she likes to be really submissive. And I was really, really worried that people were going to write in and talk about how she wasn't a feminist because of that, or it wasn't okay to submit to anyone in that kind of situation. And instead, what we actually heard were the majority of women writing and saying, I have the exact same experience, and able to talk about that in a holistic way, saying that we all feel the need to be balanced, our assertive sides and our submissive sides, whether we're male or female, and that this was a way for her to safely do that. And the outpouring of support was wonderful, and I'm actually finding that one of the best aspects. So when people write in and say, my body, you know, a woman wrote in last weekend talking about being a female ejaculator, and people write in saying, I have the exact same experience, and starting to realize that all the things about our bodies and our sexual practices that we think of as weird or freaky or I'm the only one who does it, there's always someone else engaging in that exact same behavior, possibly at that exact same moment. So it's a good place to build community around these kinds of things.
Given our culture's definitions of what's sexy, it's so often objectifying and even degrading to women. You see anything from Playboy to Maxim, and it's often just about putting women, yeah, in these equating submission, or at least, you know, debasing with being sexy. And people absorb those ideas. So what's your philosophy for striking out a space for women that's both sexy and feminist, kind of building on, you know, I'm not trying to judge anybody that feels like sexual submission is their thing, but I feel, do you see what I'm getting at? How do you kind of create a new space where women can feel comfortable being both sexy and feminist when so much of the messages we get about what's sexy just take subjectivity out of it?
I think one thing that's been amazing for our generation of women is taking those messages about what it means to be a feminist and really putting them through what modern media shoves at us as women, that this is what you're supposed to look like. And I think the most important thing to do in that is to readapt them. You can't ignore these messages. They're out there constantly. But it's about owning. I'm a woman who loves to wear heels, loves to dress very feminine, but I very much feel like that's my choice. And that's how I best express who I am in this space. and to there's no way of removing the fact that media has an impact on who I am and who women are in this world, but it's about owning the ways in which that happens and reconstituting them so that they fit who we are. And at times rejecting those messages and at times saying, you know, I'm not going to spend $40 on a Wonder Bra because that's not who I am. It doesn't fit my feminist ideals, but I'm still going to dress the way that feels best for me.
We have a lot of discussions on this podcast about comprehensive sex education, which, you know, is sadly in our policy debates being currently defined as one that just even acknowledges contraceptive use and the risk of STDs. But I'd like to kind of get beyond that and get your opinion on this. If you had your way, what would comprehensive sex education for young people include?
Comprehensive sex education for young people would be not just, would be a way of teaching them to take care of their bodies, so avoiding pregnancy and STDs, but through loving themselves instead of being a fear-based message. So saying to someone, you are worth a person using a condom or using a dental dam or using birth control pills because you are worth protecting yourself in that way, versus saying, you need to do this, otherwise you are a dirty girl or a shameful girl. And this kind of mixed message we say that you're supposed to be hypersexual. At the same time, women are the gatekeepers of purity. So young women, women of all ages are left somewhere in between. And I think real positive comprehensive sexuality education needs to come from a positive place about us all reaching our potential, whatever that may be for the individual, and not saying simply because a 15-year-old girl is pregnant and decides to carry to term that she is somehow bad or less worthy, but respecting what her choices are, what her agency is in that situation, and helping to build her as an individual versus just constantly tearing down young people.
You can read Professor Foxy's column every weekend at Feministine.com. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Now listen up.
If you haven't read Mary Roach's book, Bonk, you really, really should. It's a journey through the world of scientific research about sex, and Roach is an extremely funny writer, so she takes an already interesting topic and makes it more interesting. Now it's out in trade paperback, so that's all the more reason to pick up a copy. Roach also did a talk at TED, which stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, and it's a big conference where people talk about big ideas. And Roach talked about the often bizarre world of sex research in her talk, 10 Things You Didn't Know About Orgasms. The first thing she talks about, right off the bat, is the sort of thing that would make your average fetus worshipper's mind blow right up.
The title is Observations of In Utero Masturbation. Okay, now on the left, you can see the hand, that's the big arrow, and the penis on the right, the hand hovering. And over here we have, in the words of radiologist Israel Meisner, the hand grasping the penis in a fashion resembling masturbation movements. Bear in mind, this was an ultrasound, so it would have been moving images. And
Yep, masturbating fetuses. Of course, by the time a fetus is developed enough to try out that particular skill set, it's pretty far along in a pregnancy. I can't imagine a wingnut trying to claim that this is just further evidence that women shouldn't have abortion rights, but this is really past the point where said rights apply. But setting aside the one-track mind stuff, what's really amazing about this is that it shows, contrary to the hopes and dreams of the abstinence-only crew, sexuality is an unavoidable part of life, and not something you can put on ice and only awaken when marriage makes it necessary. What's refreshing about hearing and reading Roach on this subject is that she has no time or energy for the ridiculous controversy about sex that plagues our nation. Fundamentally, the discourse about birth control, education, abortion rights, gay rights, it all comes back to this religious belief not only that sex is nasty, but that it can be plucked out of human experience and treated not like a body function, but as a special luxury only available to people who've jumped through an extensive set of hoops. In Roach's more realistic world, sex and orgasm specifically are inseparable from life. And they have health benefits.
Okay, in 1999, in the state of Israel, a man began hiccuping. And this was one of those cases. It went on and on. He tried everything his friends suggested. Nothing seemed to help. Days went by. At a certain point, the man, still hiccuping, had sex with his wife. And lo and behold, the hiccups went away. And he told his doctor, who published a case report in a Canadian medical journal under the title, Sexual Intercourse is a Potential Treatment for Intractable Hiccups.
But it's not just that orgasm can cure the hiccups. For people who deeply, sincerely believe that human sexuality has only one real purpose, and that's procreation, I'm sure they'll be saddened to find out that your ability to procreate is actually damaged by an unwillingness to engage in sexual immorality. It's true. As counterintuitive as it might seem, if you want to make babies, you have to make some time for yourself, at least if you're a guy.
There's another way that orgasm might boost fertility. This one involves men. Sperm that sit around in the body for a week or more start to develop abnormalities that make them less effective at headbanging their way into the egg. British sexologist Roy Levin has speculated that this is perhaps why men evolved to be such enthusiastic and frequent masturbators. He said, if I keep tossing myself off, I get fresh sperm being made.
Sadly, there's no excuse yet for women who want to masturbate. Except, of course, that it harms no one and feels good. Safest sex there is. Which is reason enough in my book, and if you're a fan of this theory, you should watch Roach's whole talk to hear about the woman who could orgasm just by thinking about it. While Roach paints a picture of the reality-based world where sex is intertwined with everyday life, she does unfortunately have to touch on the times when the fundamentalist hostility to sex has dramatic and sad influence on people's lives. Granted, she does touch on it in the weirdest possible way.
It was a case report of a woman who had an orgasm every time she brushed her teeth. This was, then this was something in the complex sensory motor action of brushing her teeth was triggering orgasm. And she went to a neurologist who was fascinated, and you know, he checked to see if it was something in the toothpaste, but no, it happened with any brand. They stimulated her gums with a toothpick to see if that was doing it. Nope, it was the whole, you know, motion. And the amazing thing to me is that, you would think this woman would like have excellent oral hygiene. Sadly, this is what it said in the journal paper, she believed that she was possessed by demons and switched to mouthwash for her oral care. It's so sad.
So that's why you should be sex positive. It might help you improve your dental hygiene one day. Because any dentist will tell you that mouthwash just isn't enough. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts, hiding behind the children edition. This is the National Organization for Marriage's latest attempt to scare you about gay marriage.
Grandma, my teacher says, if Grandpa was a girl, it's okay. You can still be married.
If we change the definition of marriage,
God created Adam and Eve. That was so old-fashioned.
Our kids will be taught a new way of thinking.
He should have created Anna and Eve. If my dad married a man, who would be my mom? I'm confused.
Marriage is between a man and a woman.
The false assumption in the ad is that kids have the kind of stupidity that it takes to be homophobic. In reality, it takes years of work to be that stupid. Kids can understand gay just like they can understand straight. I remember when my cousin was a little kid and told her mom that she knew what gay was. Her mom got all nervous, but my cousin said, "It's when a boy kisses a boy." And that's all there was to it. Kids aren't the closed-minded bigots here, and it's shameful to see the actual bigots hide behind children.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.